Isn't it true we fight about anything and everything?
Yes.
I mean, you know, how you drive, you know, get in the left lane. I am in the left lane, you know, that kind of stuff. We fight about it. It takes very little for the fur to fly in most marriages. In fact, you're going to think we were making this up. We were in a counseling session not long ago talking with a couple.
True.
And they were having a fight, a continual fight, because she did not like the way he breathed. That's the truth. That's when we knew we fight about anything.
Yes, we do.
And everything.
And I don't know if you guys are like us, but we often even have some of our worst fights in public. I don't know what it is about us, but that happens to us. I don't know if that
happens
to you.
Anybody else ever had a fight in public? Oh, you liars. Everybody in here has had a fight in public. We've just had some of our worst fights in the most public of places.
We have. In fact, one of the, you know, do you have fights in your marriage that kind of become defining moments? In other words, your spouse really never lets you forget that moment or the words that were said in that moment and that kind of thing. They just go down as a part of your story. We had one of those times early in our marriage. It was a weekend away with our good friends Randy and Pam to the city of San Francisco. Now, for all four of us, we had never been to that great city. We are so excited. We're having this time off. So the first thing we do, we pull into the city and we go right for the cable car station because we think, of course, that's it. That's what you do. You get the view of the city. So here we are and we're waiting. And of course, it's this long line. It's a gorgeous sunny day. And, you know, we're trying to have fun in line, but we're impatient. Finally, Les, who is rather type A personality in his style, says, you know, I don't really think we need to be waiting in this line. I'm pretty sure if we just go up to the top of this hill, we can catch a cable car without waiting down here at the station.
They said, are you sure you know what you're talking about? I said, oh, yeah, I know what I'm talking about. And, you know, I'd seen the Rice-A-Roni commercials. I knew you could do this.
So we're very trusting. You know, we all trudge up the hill and are waiting on the street corner not long. Randy and Les turn to Pam and to me and they say, okay, you know, girls, are you ready? Are you ready for this? We're thinking, well, yeah. I mean, we've been waiting in line. We want to ride the cable car. Isn't that obvious? But what we don't realize...
Let me just interrupt you just for a second. How many of you have ridden a cable car in San Francisco? Okay, you've all done something we haven't done. I just want to clear that up. Just want to get that clear right at the top.
You know, here comes this cable car zooming by. Well, Les and Randy understand the program. We do not. You know this. They don't stop. They just kind of zoom by. They have to slow down at the crest of the hill, and if you're lucky, you can leap on. You know, all the people that waited at the station are already on the car, both hanging out and in, and if you can, you know, make a place for yourself, you can do it. So here comes the first cable car. We all scramble. Randy and Les make it on, of course. Pam and I don't even come close. I mean, we didn't even hit the cable car. So, they, you know, they're all the way up two or three blocks away, and they look back and go, oh, I wonder where the, you know, our wives are, and we're kind of waving, and so...
It dawns on us, they didn't understand you have to push people off in order to get on with it.
So they come back, and we kind of regroup, and, you know, Leslie, Pam, do you understand this? And let's try this again. And so we all revved up, and Pam and I are, you know, ready, and we're going to make a leap for it, and we can do this. So here comes the next cable car. Well, Pam's right in front of me, and we all go to make a leap. She's right in front of me, though, and she slips when she hits a cable car and falls down, you know, and so I'm scrambling out of the way. Les jumps off, tries to, you know, move her out of harm's way.
No, he's oblivious. He realizes his wife has fallen off.
So here's Pam now, and, you know, we wave Randy back, and now she's got a hole in her jeans. She's got a bloody knee, you know, this whole thing.
Randy comes back. She's still sitting on the ground. Randy comes back to her and says, Pam, are you okay? And she says, I don't know. I guess so. And so Randy looks at me and goes, good, let's catch the next car when it comes along.
Now, at this point, Les can see the fear in my face. My idea of vacation is not a bloody knee, you know? And so...
Well, I didn't just see it on her face. I mean, she was telling me, I'm scared to death. I'm not going to do this. And so I just thought she needed some advice, and I told her, listen, all you got to do is trust me. I said, I have made it on two out of two times. I said, all you got to do is trust me. I said, as a matter of fact, just hold my arm when this next thing comes along. So she said, oh, I guess so, okay. And so this is the third time around. You with me, guys? Third time. The car comes along. We jump onto this thing. I grab onto this pole. And as I do so, Leslie's going, "We're not going to make it. We're not going to make it." And I'm saying, "Look, we've made it. I just pushed that guy off the thing. We're here, you know?" And she's saying, "No." And she starts to pull me off, saying, "We're not going to make it. This isn't safe. We're not." And I'm saying, "Listen, we've made it." And she pulls me off of this car. I am so frustrated. You understand, we've spent half of our vacation now trying to get on this thing.
The quick way.
And I am so frustrated. I just say the very first thing that registers in my mind, and it just, you know, popped in there. I yelled out at the top of my lungs. I look at her and I said, "I have a brain, you know." I just thought it was important people understand that. And everybody's cranking their necks to see who has the brain, you know. And then the next thing that popped into my mind, I hollered out too, and I said, "All you had to do was trust me." And Leslie uttered back something that I'll never, ever let her forget in our marriage. You remember what you said, of course.
Yes, of course. And, you know, at this point, the tears are bubbling up, you know, so my voice is breaking. I don't know how this came out, but I said, "Well, to be honest, I trust God for my safety, but I don't trust you."
People were really cranking their necks now. Who's the theological couple with the big brain? Randy and Pam were coming back towards us when we were in the middle of this discussion, and they kind of heard that and then just turned on their heels and walked the other way, you know?
And we never rode the cable cars.
No, not to this day. Probably never will. A lot of warm memories there. I don't know. Maybe you don't have fights like that. I hope you don't. But we all fight, isn't it true? I mean, it's just a part of married life. If you're together long enough, you're going to have some tension. You're going to have some conflicts. And if you don't, it's because you're tiptoeing around on things and you're not genuine with each other, right? We all have conflict. In fact, my favorite verse in all of Scripture on conflict, Romans 12, is it 18? And it says this: "If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, try to live at peace with everyone." Isn't that a good verse? If it's possible. You know why I love that verse? Because I don't know of another verse in all of Scripture that has more qualifiers in it than that verse. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, try, do what you can, you know. But you can expect conflict to be a part of married life. It's just there. I love what the great philosopher Phyllis Diller said. She said, "Never go to bed mad, stay up and fight." Pretty good advice. Carl Jung said something a little more insight. He said, "Conflict is like fire." He says it has two aspects, that of burning and that of shedding light. And what we want to do with the time that we have with you this morning, as we kick this whole day off, is to kind of roll up our sleeves and talk about, how do you fight a fair fight, a good fight? How do you do that? And how do you use conflict to your advantage? You know, because the truth is, conflict is the price we pay for a deeper level of intimacy. If you know how to fight a good fight, you can use conflict to your advantage, and rather than allow it to burn up your love life, allow it to enhance that. And boy, I can't think of any of us that don't need to learn how to do that.
In fact, and I love that picture of conflict as fire, because it really is that powerful. It can burn up a relationship, and it also can shed light and increase intimacy. And we know that. In fact, at the university where we teach in Seattle, Seattle Pacific University, it's on a canal, and right across the canal from us is a little place affectionately known as the Love Lab, and it's where the work of a premier researcher in the area of conflict in marriage takes place, Dr. John Gottman. Now, in this lab, they simply invite couples to come and stay in this lab, and then what they do, and they've done this for three decades now, is they just let them live their life and analyze what goes on in their conflict.
It's just like any other day for these couples. They respond to an ad in the newspaper. They come in. They live in this. It's like a little studio apartment for the day. It's just like that, except that it has a camera in each of the four corners of the room that's watching them for the entire experience. Behind one wall is a bank of computers and screens and so forth, and there's a team of researchers back there that is noting every facial expression both of the people make throughout the entire day, every time they grin or whatever and they're keeping track of all this stuff. They're also hooked up to biofeedback equipment so that they have their heart rate is being measured, their galvanic skin response, you know, the skin temperature. There's little electrodes around their forehead measuring their muscle tension. Other than that, it's just like any other day for these couples.
Now, I have to tell you that this research is powerful, and let me tell you why. They have discovered now, after 3 decades of working with couples in conflict, that they can predict with a greater than 94% accuracy rate whether a couple's marriage will succeed or fail based on nothing else but how they fight.
Isn't that amazing? With a greater than 90% accuracy rate, they can tell you whether a marriage will succeed or fail, and we've seen them do this firsthand,
yes,
based on nothing other. They don't know anything else about the couple except how they fight.
And I think what's good news for us as couples, it's not how frequently you fight. Every couple has their own style there, and it's not even what we fight about. I mean, that's different for every couple. Those did not turn out to be significant things, but what they discovered, there are 4 things, elements in our conflict, in the way we fight, that if we have these, they are very destructive to our relationship.
Yeah, they call them the 4 red flags, or actually Dr. Gottman calls them the 4 horsemen of the apocalypse. Right?
That's a powerful picture.
These are 4 things, yeah, that kind of usher in doom,
yes,
for a marriage relationship.
Right.
If he sees these in a marriage, then that's what he bases his prediction on. Would you like to know what they are? All in favor say aye.
All right.
Number 1.
The first horseman of the apocalypse is criticism, just simply criticism. You know, Les said we had one of our fights right before we were speaking at a marriage seminar, and I happened to be about 30 minutes late. Now, you know, you wouldn't think we had a genuine marriage if he wasn't going to complain if I'm 30 minutes late when we're speaking at a marriage seminar. And so what do you do in those moments, you know? And it's so easy to criticize. If I walk in the door and he says, "Where have you been? You always make us late." That is a critical comment right there. That's a destructive thing to your marriage.
Right.
You know.
By the way, he found something very interesting. I think it's very good news for a lot of us, and that is there's a big difference between criticism and complaining.
Yes.
In fact, here's the good news. They discovered in this research lab that complaining is actually good for a marriage.
Let me say that again.
Complaining is actually good for a marriage. Isn't that good news for all of us whiners? What is the difference? Well, it's very subtle. The difference is that criticism almost always begins with you. You always make us late,
right?
Whereas complaining almost always begins with I feel so frustrated when we're late to something that really matters to me,
right?
So it's just a subtle difference in the way it's expressed, but they discovered it makes a big difference in how it's
absolutely
received.
And you can almost feel these as we talk about them. They're a progression. The second horseman of the apocalypse is the natural progression after you receive a criticism. And it's defensiveness. And you know, you just can feel yourself just almost reflexively responding to a critical comment, and you're ready to go. You know, if Les walks in the door and it's the middle of the week and it's late, he's been teaching a class till 8 o'clock at night, and he's hungry, and he drops his briefcase and says, "You know, how are you doing? What's for dinner?" And I say, "You know what? I don't know. Can you hop in the car and go find us something to eat tonight?" You know? And he says to me, "Man, tonight I just wish I could come home and have a hot meal ready." What do I say in that moment, you know? Because he hasn't criticized me, but the defensiveness, I can just feel it winding up, and it's so easy for me to say something like, "Well, if we were ever home on the weekend, you know, like a normal couple and could shop, or I didn't have a 2-year-old and have to teach," or whatever it is. You know, you just feel yourself going into that reflexive, defensive response. Gottman said that always escalates an argument. It never helps bring resolve. Defensiveness is really lethal to a couple.
And it's just a natural response.
Right.
Once you've been criticized, you're going to do that. In fact, some of us get so entrenched in that, it becomes such a habit that it's almost like any response. I mean, it's just, have you seen my car keys? Well, I didn't take them. We just defend ourselves against anything. And we can become what some have called jellyfish in armor,
right,
you know, and we're so tough on the exterior, but inside we're just dying because we're so well guarded, defensive.
Right.
Criticism, defensiveness, and the third of these red flags is
contempt. Now, contempt is like criticism, but it's deeper and even more injurious to the relationship. Contempt is now not when you're just saying something like, "You always make us late," but now you're engaging in what we would call character assassination. You're assigning a negative motive to them. "You always make us late because you're so irresponsible.
And
you don't care."
And it's often sarcastic,
right,
and, "Oh, that's brilliant, you know, tell me what time we're supposed to meet when I'm half asleep," you know, it's that kind of tone. Sometimes the most contemptuous thing that we do is without words. Do you know what it is? Yeah, it's just the rolling of the eyes, right?
Right.
You ever done that? You ever seen that on your partner's face? Oh, brother, right?
Yeah, in fact, you know, we talked about these couples in this love lab, and it is so interesting whenever they're wired up like that and they're having a conversation. They'll just give them a project, like say, oh, just talk about, you know, build a tower together, or talk about some issue that seems a little unresolved for you. And as they're talking, if one partner rolls their eyes at the other, their heart rate goes crazy. I mean, we know when we're on the receiving end of that nonverbal contempt. We know when we're getting that message from our partner.
Right. So criticism, defensiveness, contempt, that leads to the fourth of these, which is stonewalling. Stonewalling. And let me tell you something about stonewalling. This is the experience of, you just shut down emotionally. You're no longer, it's just like you're talking to a stone wall. And let me just tell you something. Men tend to get to stonewalling quicker than women do. All right? Now, also, women tend to...
Right, more frequently tend to have a critical comment that they spark an argument with. So you can kind of see how cyclical our fights can be sometimes as couples.
But guys, you can feel this sometimes in your shoulders. It goes up into the trapezius muscles here and up through the neck, right? And you just feel like a stone wall. And you might say something like, okay, what do you want me to do? I'll do it, right? What do you want me to say? I'll say it. You ever done that? Raise your hand. No, you don't have to do that. Some of you did. Wow.
Boy, I like that genuineness.
And one guy was really proud of it back there. I have. Is there a prize? What do I get? Yeah.
And in fact, the truth is, all of us do have moments where we experience these things in our marriages. So if you're starting to identify with these, you know, four horsemen, don't get nervous yet, because the truth is, they happen for us as couples. It's when it becomes an inevitable cycle. Anytime you guys, you know, have a disagreement, you know you're going to inevitably start with a critical comment and cycle right into this withdrawal and with no resolve that you really need to start to feel the danger.
Right, so don't feel too uptight if you have these from time to time. Everybody has some of these from time to time, but it's when you start with a critical comment and oh boy, here we go again, set aside the next half hour because we're going to go through these four cycles. That's when it gets dangerous. Well, we want to help you kind of short circuit this whole thing. If this is what bad fights are made of, how do we spin out of this, you know, cycle?
Right.
And we want to give you some new tools for doing that. And the first one's real quick that
very
has
simple.
Been very helpful to us over the years. It's what we call the XYZ formula.
And this is simple, and yet we feel very profound. When you're in the heat of a conflict, you need something that your memory can grab onto that protects you from doing something that's destructive to each other. And so if you can remember this, the simple formula, the XYZ, in situation X, when you do Y, I feel Z.
Right, the XYZ formula. In situation X, when you do Y, I feel Z. When we're driving down the road, and you turn the radio station without asking me first, well, I feel like I don't even matter to you, right? Now that's very different than saying, who made you king of the radio? Right? That's contempt. Get that subtle difference? Right. In situation X, when you do Y, I feel Z. So that's just a good way to kind of circumvent the criticism.
A simple way to protect you from the critical comment which starts the whole thing rolling.
Right. And make a complaint rather than a criticism.
Right.
Well, that's one thing we want to toss out there. Should we teach them the withholds?
Yes.
We have another exercise we want to teach you that we've literally taught to thousands of couples. We get such a good response to this. It's worked for us for at least the last decade of our own marriage and in lots of other couples' lives. It's called sharing withholds. Every day in every marriage, there is information that we withhold from one another. Not because we're being secretive or because we're private or whatever.
It's just the pace of life and the way things go. I mean, we can, you know, be out to dinner with some friends and, you know, we're all having a great time. He might say something, though, that kind of hurts my feelings. I'm not going to bring it up, you know, with everyone. I'm going to laugh. And then we get home and it's like midnight and I'm too tired to bring it up. Don't want to talk about it. We go to bed. We're up at 6 the next morning and life takes off. And those things happen. You just have moments where you felt something and you just couldn't, you couldn't get it in. You couldn't share it. And those become negative withholds, you know, just feelings.
And we have negative withholds as well as positive. What happens, by the way, to negative withholds when you never express those? What happens to them? Yeah, that's right. We bury those and they pop up. They have a high rate of resurrection.
Yes, they do.
They will pop up through the surface and wonder, where did that come from, right? Yeah. Well, we also have positive withholds, things that register in our minds and they somehow never get expressed. And so I see Leslie, she's coming down the stairs, and we're headed to church, and I'm thinking, oh, she has that new dress on. She looks great in that new dress, and I'm just ready to give her that compliment. And then I think, oh, where's my Bible? Where's that Sunday school lesson? Where are my car keys? Or whatever it is. And I get sidetracked, and I never do give her that verbal appreciation and compliment. She misses out on that because of the speed of life.
And we do that all the time, both positive and negative withholds. Now, this exercise, sharing withholds, is so powerful in helping you cope with conflict in a marriage, because what it does is you engage in this, and it really then takes the tension out of your daily life together as a couple.
Absolutely. Here's how this goes. One of us will just simply initiate this exercise by saying, would you like to share withholds? The other person agrees. We both get out a piece of scratch paper, and
right.
We write down three withholds that have happened within the last couple of days, the last 48 hours. Three withholds. The way we do this is two of them need to be positive, one of them is negative. Two positive withholds, one negative withhold. Right? You all with me? So we each jot these down, and then we take turns sharing them.
So, I'll take my turn, and I'll start with the positive. You know, one of the things I wanted you to know, I was just so overwhelmed when I came down yesterday morning and the kitchen was clean, and I couldn't believe it because I went to bed at midnight. It was a wreck. Dishes everywhere. I was exhausted. I could not get it together.
Right.
And so I was dreading that and leaving town and the whole thing. So I woke up, went in the kitchen. It was beautiful, and I wanted you to know how much that meant to me.
Oh. I respond. By the way, that never happened. I was a little startled there. I knew she was sending me a message. That's all. We have our own little seminar going on up here right now. Thanks, Les. But if it had happened, I would respond with two words. Those two words are, yeah, thank you. That's all. I'm not going to explain it or anything else. I just say thank you. And then she would share a negative withhold.
You know, I have to tell you that I had fun with Kevin and Kathy last week when we went to dinner. But at one point, you know, we were laughing. I mean, I did laugh so hard, but you made that comment about me talking to my mom on the phone and how big the long distance bill is. And I got to tell you, it hurt my feelings because, you know, I'm so worried about her. I live far away from her. I don't feel like there's much I can do except talk to her. And I just got my feelings hurt, and I wanted you to know that.
Okay. So in this exercise, I just simply respond to the negative withhold by saying, lighten up, I can't believe you take this so seriously. Every fiber in my body wants to respond that way, right? But in this exercise, I respond with two words, and those two words are, no, not I'm sorry, because I may not be sorry yet, okay? Those two words are simply, thank you, that's all, right? Not going to explain it, it's not going to be a coerced kind of apology.
Right.
Just, this is an exercise in sharing information, so I say thank you. All right? And then she would share another positive withhold,
right.
And then it would be my turn to share my three withholds. And by the way, if you're the second person to share your three withholds, one of the things we've discovered is that you need to stick with the three original withholds you wrote down. You're way ahead of us. All right. So we do this,
right.
And then here's the caveat for this thing. For the next 30 minutes, the negative withholds are off limits. For the next 30 minutes,
right.
We don't talk about those. Now, what happens in 30 minutes' time to the human system? When we have that, we've received negative information, what happens after we've held on to it for about 30 minutes without responding to it? Yeah, that's right. A little sanity begins
right.
to seep into that cortex of ours, and we come to a place where we can respond rather than react. And most of the time, we don't even come back.
Honestly,
to them.
That's a surprise for me that I feel so confident that he heard my feelings. He knew me. We didn't have to have a big argument about it. We didn't have to process it for an hour. He knew my feelings and listened to me respectfully. And I know that it impacted him. And so the anxiety about it dissolves. That's been the amazing thing about this. Now, there are times when issues are big enough and you do need to come back to those. And, you know, after that time when you've had a cooling off period, you do that. Occasionally, it may be even a larger issue where you need more time, and that's okay.
But we still haven't really answered the question, how is conflict the price we pay for a deeper level of intimacy?
Right.
And let me see if I can do this very quickly before we wrap things up. I think the answer is found in understanding how relationships work. Every relationship begins at a level that we might call pseudo-relationship or false relationship. You know, it's about that deep. There's just not much to it. In pseudo relationship, it's the kind of relationship we have with somebody. Oh, you might see him in the church foyer, you know, and you see him once in a while in the church foyer, and it's like, what's your name?
Mac.
Like, how you doing, Mac? It's good to see you. Man, isn't this a wonderful day? And I can't believe that message. It was fabulous. Hey, how's the golf game going? Still going well?
Oh, not bad.
Oh, that's great. Hey, it's good to see you, all right? You take it. You're the man. Mac, you are the man. You take care, all right? You know, Mac and I, we do that every so often. The church foyer, we happen to see each other. If you thought, you know, somebody asked you, hey, are Mac and Les friends? You'd say, yeah, I think they might even golf together. I'm not sure, but I know they're friends. I see them talking together. But that's all we ever do. Just an inch deep, you know? That's pseudo-relationship. Now, if Mac and I got in an automobile and we drove from California to Washington, D.C., starting this afternoon, you think that relationship might get to a different level? Yeah, you bet. Eventually, it would get to the second level that we call, and put your seatbelts on, the second level of relationships is called chaos. Chaos. What happens in chaos? Well, this is where you start to get real. And that's what creates the chaos, when you start to get genuine. And it's like, hey, Mac, man, it's good to see you. How you doing, brother? Wasn't that a good message? And I can't get over this weather. It's been fabulous, hasn't it? And hey, how's the golf game? Hey, I wanted to ask you about your golf game. You know, I was at the cafe the other day. I saw John there. He said, oh, yeah, Mac and I, we just got back from playing 18. I thought, well, that's strange, because you keep saying, yeah, well, I'm going to invite you next time we go. We're going to invite you. I know you got my phone number. I've given it to you 23 times, and yet you haven't invited me. And I'm just not sure what this is all about. Now you got that smirk on your face. I really don't understand what's going on with you. Yeah. Yeah, I used to think you were the man. You are no longer the man. And Mac's going, yikes, back off. All right, you can come golf, okay? You know, and what's he going to do the next time he sees me in the church foyer? That's right. Yeah, come on, kids. Here comes Les. Let's get out of here. Right? He's crazy. Well, that's chaos.
Right,
a lot of times we stay in chaos a long time. But if we have the maturity,
right,
we can move to the third stage of relationship, which is emptiness. Emptiness. And we're not talking about an existential void here. We're talking about the capacity to empty yourself of your need to change another person, even your spouse. The capacity, everybody in this room and around the country listening in on this seminar today has to empty themselves of their need to change another person. That's a tough thing to do, isn't it? Yeah, it's a tough thing to do. We could really have. I remember Leslie and I first got married.
Yes.
We're in our tiny little kitchen. We're making a salad together. I don't know why. We just thought that's probably something married couples do. And so we're making a salad together. And I look at Leslie, and she's cutting carrots. And Leslie's left-handed. I can't begin to tell you how she was holding that carrot and that knife. I said, Les, what are you doing? And she says, I'm cutting carrots. I said, well, that's not the way you cut. And I taught her the right way to cut carrots. I left the room. I came back in a few minutes. And she was back to her way of cutting carrots. I said, Les, what are you doing? Oh, yeah, I forgot. So she goes back to my way of cutting carrots. A week later, I come into the kitchen. She's cutting carrots by herself. How do you think she's cutting them? Yeah. Les, how many times we got to cover this ground? Well, we've been married for 16 years. How do you think she cuts carrots today? Here's the goofy part. I was in our kitchen. We were I was answering mail and stuff on the phone and sitting at this little island that we have, and Leslie was making a salad 16 years into our marriage. I look across the way, and all of a sudden it dawns on me, there she is cutting carrots the exact same way she's cut them ever since we've been married, right? Never cut her fingers amazingly, but she's still cutting those carrots that same way. And here's the funny part. I would have been disappointed if she was cutting them any other way. For some reason, I just like that about her. That's the way my Leslie cuts carrots. I like that. I must have somewhere along the line emptied myself and said, hey, I'm going to be married to a crazy carrot-cutting fool the rest of my days. Emptiness. It's a remarkable experience.
You know, and I've got to just tell you that it is an amazing thing when you're on the receiving end of that gift from your spouse. In fact, you know, every marriage, I'm pretty sure every marriage like us has ongoing issues. One of the things we've struggled with for all 16 years of our marriage is this expectation when we're on the road, you know, when Les is driving, that, you know, I might help with the maps and kind of be a navigator in the front seat. Now, when we got...
It's because I grew up in a home where Mom always did the navigating. She did the maps, just like a loving wife should do.
Now, I got to tell you, I was unprepared for this in marriage because in my family, my dad did all the maps. I mean, I think maps were my dad's hobby, you know, and he didn't want us to do any map reading because he did not trust us to fold them back up after we'd looked at them, you know? So I don't know anything about a map.
We were in downtown Seattle, this was a few months back, and we were in downtown Seattle, and we were lost. It was dark. It was rainy. I could not find this restaurant. We were meeting another couple for the first time, and I said to Leslie, I said, you've got to help me. And she gets out this map, and I know she's working at it so hard. She's poring over it for 5 minutes. She said, Les, I've looked all over this map. She said, this street does not exist in downtown Seattle. I looked over at her. The upper right-hand corner of the map said Spokane, Washington.
So here's the thing. You know, for all of our married life, you know, when you're lost and late, it's a point of attention. And I'm never helpful in these moments. And it's always been disappointing to Les. Well, this time, for whatever reason, he was just in that place. And he just, you know, I looked up. He starts laughing. Finally, he is laughing so hard when he sees that I'm looking at the wrong city's map, that his shoulders are shaking. He has to pull over on the side of the road because he's laughing too hard to drive. And we just start laughing together. And even though we're late and it's dark and it's raining, we have this moment. And I have got to tell you, I have never felt so good in my life. It's like when you're with someone who knows your faults and has decided you're okay exactly that way, it creates that feeling of safety. It is the safest place on earth to be.
That's
in a relationship
emptiness.
In
and
that
emptiness
place.
Leads to the final stage of relationship, which is genuine relationship.
Right.
And friend, this is where you just go, you can be who you are, and it doesn't matter.
Right.
That's what we all long for. That's that longing for belonging we have in the soul of our marriage that we all desire. And when you arrive there, we have friends we'll go out with, and we come back at the end of the evening, and I'll go, do you have a good time? So, yeah, it was okay. Yeah, I said, I don't know if they understood my sense of humor, and then I tripped up those stairs. I know they think I'm a klutz, you know, and you start to evaluate. Then we have another group of friends we can go out with. Doesn't matter what happens all evening, we're going to have a good time.
Right.
You know, if I fall flat on my face, they just go, oh, yeah, that's Les. He falls a lot. Pick him up. Right? That's genuine
right.
relationship. It's no longer pseudo relationship. You've journeyed through a little bit of chaos
right.
to get there. And now all of a sudden, just like sitting in a big, fat, leather, easy chair, you just want to stay there for a while. Oh, this is comfortable. Right? And that's our prayer for you, that you would enjoy the depth of genuine relationship
right.
in your marriage. And realize that many times conflict, chaos, is the price you pay in order to get there and enjoy that experience. We know you're already there. Many of you are enjoying that. But it's sometimes helpful to remember conflict is the price. If it's possible, far as it depends on you, try. Do what you can to live at peace with one another.
Right.
Thanks, folks. Great to be with you.